U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Senator Joe Manchin pulls his permitting proposal from a bill to fund the government as the first lawsuit is filed against President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, columnists Kim Strassel and Alicia Finley. Welcome to you both. With a deadline to fund the government looming only days away, Senator Joe Manchin found himself on Tuesday unable to round up enough support for his promised permitting reform deal, which was pulled from the continuing resolution to fund the government. And let's listen to Majority Leader Chuck Schumer in the Senate announcing this decision.
Senate Republicans have made very clear they will block legislation to fund the government if it includes bipartisan permitting reform, because they've chosen to obstruct instead of work in a bipartisan way to achieve something they've long claimed they wanted to do. Because American families should not be subject to a Republican-manufactured government shutdown, Senator Manchin has requested, and I have agreed, to move forward and pass the recently filed continuing resolution legislation without the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2022. Senator Manchin, myself, and others will continue to have conversations about the best way to ensure responsible permitting reform is passed before the end of the year.
Kim, what has happened here? Because last I checked, Democrats control the House of Representatives, Democrats control the Senate, and didn't Chuck Schumer promise Joe Manchin that he would get this permitting deal done?
Yeah. Well, here's a few things that were wrong in that Schumer statement. So for beginners, in order to pass this continuing resolution to fund the government, you need 60 votes. And while he sat there and lectured that this was a bipartisan bill, the reality is that he didn't even have all the Democrats on board with this. Bernie Sanders had already come out and said he was opposed to it. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey had also come out and said he was opposed, which means that Republicans would have had to fill in the gap. And you would have had to have had at least 12 of them say yes. And while there were a couple that were willing to go along, many of them were very opposed to this bill because it was not bipartisan. Notably, when Senator Manchin wrote an op-ed on our pages a few days ago, he was very careful with his words. And he said, you know, this bill is bipartisan. Republicans have had lots of input into the substance of what makes up this bill, meaning he was claiming that he'd drawn on some of their ideas, but he certainly didn't negotiate with any of them over this. And in fact, they had a bill of their own put forward by the other West Virginia senator, Shelley Moore Capito. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, whipped very hard on this because he felt that the GOP product was much better. And there's some other things that went into it too. But the bottom line is this was meant to be a clean funding bill to keep the government open. Chuck Schumer attempted to hitch this priority of Manchin's onto it because it was something that was promised as part of the last reconciliation deal, and the gambit failed.
And Alicia, can you take us through some of the policy details? Because it seems to me Republicans were objecting in two ways. One, they were saying that the Manchin proposal didn't go far enough to solving the permitting problem that America faces. And two, that there were some things in the Manchin bill that went way too far. And the Journal had an editorial. The headline was, "Manchin's permitting bill has a poison pill." So can you just explain a little bit each of those objections from the Republican camp?
One of the objections was, as you said, that it didn't go far enough, that it essentially set up a shot clock, so to speak, 2 years for regulatory agencies to complete the environmental reviews for bigger projects, 1 year for small projects. This was actually incorporated in the bipartisan infrastructure bill last year for transportation projects. And so this would apply it to, or these same deadlines, for energy projects. One problem with this is that nothing compels the agencies to meet these targets or deadlines. And in fact, the bill concluded a savings clause saying that nothing here shall override or change NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, that sets out the procedures for completing environmental reviews and requires these federal agencies to dot all their I's and to consider all the myriad environmental potential harms from these projects. So nothing in this Manchin bill would have changed NEPA in any way. It wouldn't have limited the litigation. It would have set up some kind of statute of limitations, 150 days for opponents to bring lawsuits. But most of the time, green groups actually sue immediately. So this actually wouldn't have cracked down on the litigation racket. And in some cases, maybe it would have prevented opponents from suing while projects were already under construction, but wouldn't have limited who can sue and actually how many times they could sue, you know, get how many bites at the apple they can get. One idea I've kind of supported is that the loser pays. So if the environmentalists lose their lawsuits, that they will have to pay for the cost, not just of the lawsuits and the litigation costs of the government, but also the uncertainty and the delays that it causes the developers, energy developers. There are two provisions in the bill that were problematic. One of the provisions would have allowed states, given them more discretion to block pipelines by revising the Clean Water Act provision to allow them to potentially block pipelines if they deem it could contribute to climate change and other indirect environmental harms rather than merely the quote-unquote discharges into waterways, which is the current law. Manchin announced early yesterday that they would actually dump that provision because it was problematic. But they didn't agree to dump this other provision that would have allowed the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to have broad power over the nation's grid. Right now, states under the Federal Power Act of 1935 permit interstate pipelines. There are historical reasons for this, but also any transmission line that goes through a state naturally connects to its grid and can alter its energy mix and will affect the balance of power, so to speak. So right now, states have this authority to permit or disapprove of transmission lines. And the Manchin bill would have allowed the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the Energy Secretary to override this power if they were deemed to be in the national energy interest. And this was very expansively interpreted to help intermittent, which is defined essentially as renewable energy, to increase their build out. This posed a number of problems for the states, for federalism, the constitutional federalism, and with the federal government basically coming in, telling states, well, you not only have to allow this transmission line be built through your states, you may also have to take this green energy from another state that could potentially drive out their own fossil fuels. I mean, we've been seeing this in other states, you know, Texas, where you've had a lot of wind power come onto the grid thanks to actually a transmission line build out from West Texas. And that has actually pushed a lot of coal plants out of business and ergo has resulted in less reliable energy. But you would start to see these problems actually expand nationwide. And actually a particular region that could be harmed by this is, you know, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, where they still have a lot of coal and nuclear, which could be squeezed out by renewable build out in the mid-Atlantic coast.
Given these Republican criticisms of the Manchin proposal, one of the arguments I've heard from their side is that they didn't want to give up hope on a better permitting bill passing. And the theory was that if this Manchin thing were added to the government funding bill and signed into law, that it would check the permitting reform box. And who knows how long it would be until Congress got back to the issue where Republicans really think that we need substantive changes. But Kim, I also would not underrate the personal aspect of this and the anger among Republicans at Joe Manchin. And remember the sequencing of this here. Manchin had blocked Democrats from passing a big budget reconciliation spending bill. Then there was this CHIPS bill, this billion-dollar CHIPS bill that came up. And Republican leader Mitch McConnell had threatened to not vote for the CHIPS bill if Democrats were still going to do a reconciliation bill. Eventually, what happened was Republicans did vote for that CHIPS bill. And then lo and behold, shortly thereafter, Joe Manchin made this deal and announced that he was for a reconciliation package after all. And so here's a quote from Texas Senator John Cornyn last week. He said, "Relationships are important around here, and I think people feel like he misled them. There's not a lot of sympathy on our side for providing Senator Manchin a reward for his flip-flop on the reconciliation." So, Kim, that may be part of it. And the other part of it may be, of course, the looming midterm elections in November. And maybe Republicans are thinking that there really is pressure and some Democrats who are interested in doing permitting reform. And there's a possibility we may take the House. There's a possibility we may take the Senate. And so maybe we can pass a better permitting reform bill next year, put it on Joe Biden's desk and ask him to sign it.
Yeah, I think a couple of political things were at play here. And you mentioned one of them. There is a lot of anger remaining among Republicans on Joe Manchin's approach and decisions on reconciliation. He had given many of them his promise, both publicly and privately, that he was not going to take any actions that increased the debt, risked greater inflation. And yet the pressure became so huge on him from the Democratic side that he threw all that overboard, and in the process threw over a lot of trust that he'd built up with Republicans. And so no, they weren't in a mood for this. But I think the even bigger point here is the latter one you made, Kyle, is that we are going into a midterm. And it was notable that even as things fell apart yesterday and Manchin was yanking his bill, one of the reasons he yanked it is because rather than have it officially voted down, he wanted to keep it in reserve for a potential future vehicle that maybe could get across the line. And he was said to be already talking with some Republican members about whether or not there was a way to merge or come to some sort of an agreement between the bill he has and the one that Republicans have put forward from Ms. Capito. So that's still a possibility. Now, it would be a very hard lift because environmentalists are opposed to any of this. And there are certainly a number of Democrats who are absolutely opposed to this too. But imagine a scenario in which you do get into a new Senate and Republicans have the majority. Is the pressure to get some of these projects done great enough that you could get, conversely, from the situation now, you could get 8 or 9 Democrats to come along, especially after if they potentially lost a midterm and are feeling bruised? Maybe. So this is more of a strategic point, I think, even more so than bruised feelings over reconciliation.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I mean, I guess my read on this Manchin and some last thoughts here, Manchin deal, is that he was the one who messed up the sequencing here. First of all, he angered his Republican colleagues. Then he gave up the leverage that he had over the reconciliation deal with just a promise on a piece of paper from Chuck Schumer. Then he was working behind closed doors on some sort of permitting negotiation and didn't make it public for a month or so, which made Republicans nervous. And so they put out their own permitting bill and coalesced around that instead. The one silver lining here, Alicia, is that do you suppose that the removal of the permitting issue from this government funding deal that we're now negotiating in the Senate, in the House, with a deadline for funding the government looming just days away, do you think that this lowers the possibility of one of those government shutdowns that everybody loves so much?
Right. I think that the CR bill, the continuing resolution, passes this week. I don't think there's a chance of a government shutdown. They've already removed the COVID and monkeypox funding from the negotiations. Democrats had wanted some $20 or $30 billion in aid for monkeypox and COVID. That was a no-go for Republicans. And so that sticking point has been removed. Now the permitting sticking point has been removed. And so I think that there's still some debate on whether how long the CR should go. Should it just go through December? Should it go through January, when Republicans could potentially have now then more leverage when they potentially take over a House to insert some kind of priorities to attach to the appropriations. But I don't see any chance. I think they're all eager to get out of Washington to go campaign. I don't see any chance of a government shutdown this week.
Kim, do you agree with that assessment? And how else do you think this continuing resolution is shaping up? One headline that I thought was notable was, this is the Associated Press, funding bill includes more than $12 billion on Ukraine. And I suppose that's good to hear, because the last aid package from Ukraine passed with more no votes than I think many people expected. And so I think it's good to give the Biden administration a bit of leeway there on the aid that it's sending.
Yeah, remember, this bill needs 60 votes, so you have to have buy-in on both sides. And one of the Republican demands all along was that this bill be as clean as possible, meaning continuing resolutions are supposed to be a simple kind of one-pager that just says we're going to continue funding the government at current levels until we get around to doing our job of actually passing appropriations bills. And so they are extending the deadline for a couple of months. They want it to be clean, but there are a few things that are headed in that do have broad bipartisan support. One of them, as you said, is $12.3 billion for Ukraine. I think that that was made easier and support has really strengthened, especially as Ukraine has been so successful in the last month in particular in routing Russian forces. There's a little bit of money in there for energy assistance, a program called LIHEAP. There's about $4 billion, almost $5 billion in there in disaster aid, a huge chunk of it going to New Mexico to help out after its Hermit's Peak fire. Some money in there for the water problem in Jackson, Mississippi, about $20 million, and some more money that's going to go to help with Afghani resettlement. So those are the provisions that got in that got wide support. As Alicia mentioned, all the controversial things in the end got axed, including more COVID money and monkeypox money. So I do see this going ahead quickly, everybody getting out of town, and then basically just pushing off any other problems they have until after the midterm elections.
Another big news story on Tuesday was the arrival of the first lawsuit against President Biden's plan to forgive student loans. And recall that the difficulty here was not, I think, proving that President Biden lacks the authority to take this action unilaterally. It was finding someone who had legal standing to bring a case. Because you have to have an injury. And if the government is handing out money more or less, who could you find that would be injured by that? Taxpayers can't object to that general programs that they don't like are unconstitutional. That's not something that federal courts generally find they have standing to do. But maybe there's a group called the Pacific Legal Foundation that thinks it has found the way to court here. And let's listen to one of its attorneys, Caleb Kruckenberg, speaking on Fox News about his client's lawsuit.
The question is not what's the damages to me or the Pacific Legal Foundation. It's to the people that are getting this student loan cancellation forced upon them. And for my client, Frank Garrison, who happens to be one of my colleagues, I mean, the damages are pretty clear. He is going to be stuck with a tax bill that he didn't ask for this cancellation that he doesn't want. That's going to put him in worse position than if nothing happened.
So, Alicia, my understanding is that this attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation is in a public service loan forgiveness program, which is not taxable. And the state that he's in would tax the Biden forgiveness. And so, essentially, this guy would end up, as a result of this forgiveness plan, with a tax bill of about $1,000. And, Alicia, do you think that this will meet the standing requirement to challenge the forgiveness plan?
So under Article 3, a plaintiff has to show a concrete and particularized injury, so a tangible harm that they experience personally. Now, this is kind of an interesting case. I don't know how applicable this is to most plaintiffs or most borrowers, but in this case, Frank Garrison, as you mentioned, he was enrolled in a public service loan forgiveness plan. And under these plans, he pays a share of his income every month, about 10%, after 120 payments or 10 years of payments, that the remainder balance gets forgiven. So he says he has about 4 years left of making payments, and then he would get it forgiven. And under Indiana tax law, he wouldn't have to pay a bill on that. But he says because President Biden is forgiving these loans, he would be eligible for $20,000 in loan forgiveness because he received a Pell Grant. But that doesn't change his monthly payments at all. So he actually doesn't benefit from that because they're already capped. However, he will experience, because of this, an immediate $1,000 tax liability because Indiana state does not waive the tax on just general loan forgiveness. So it's a clever and really interesting argument here. I guess one concern or worry I would have is that would a court enjoin the entire loan forgiveness or would a court just enjoin it to similarly situated plaintiffs like Mr. Garrison? And it'll be interesting to see. I think what's most important is that you just get a preliminary injunction that stops the Biden administration from administering this, which is planning to start canceling the loans within a matter of a week or two. And that could provide an opportunity for other plaintiffs. I mean, I still think that there's a good opportunity for debt collectors or federal student loan servicers to bring a case, because I think they could also have standing. But if Republicans actually get control of Congress or the House in November, they may also have an opportunity to sue the administration, just like House Republicans did when the Obama administration basically appropriated money for Obamacare subsidies that the Congress didn't appropriate it. And the judge in that case, Judge Collier, actually ruled that the House Republicans did have standing. And so I think that if Republicans win control of the House, they may be able to file a similar lawsuit. But it's important that now to get the immediate preliminary injunction, because by the time the Republicans would even have control of the House, all of the debt could already be forgiven.
Well, this case will be a fascinating one to watch. But the student loan forgiveness plan, I still think the Biden administration is underrating the political salience of this. And it has certainly agitated a lot of our Potomac Watch listeners. I'll just read a few pieces of letters. Dave says that one thing he hasn't heard mentioned is the possibility that this $10,000 is just a down payment. It could very well be that Biden is only giving out $10,000 now, so that 2 years from now, he can give out more forgiveness and buy some more votes. Jim says that if college student loan forgiveness is the ultimate $10,000 or $20,000 endorsement of school choice funded by the government, the same logic should apply to K through 12 students. And James makes an analogy to truckers. He says that a new cab for an 18-wheeler will cost between $40,000 to $120,000, which is comparable to student loan amounts. Imagine if the government decided they were going to federalize these loans. Then we find out most of these loans were given out for these trucks were not being paid back. And then we find out that many of these unpaid loans are from people who are not using their truck and are working in a job unrelated to trucking. And I think that this is just a pretty good sample, Kim, of the real anger that people who have paid back their loans or people who saved up and put the money in the 529 account for their kids to go to college and paid out of pocket for that. I still think that the more that this becomes an issue in the political debate, the worse it becomes for President Biden as we get toward Election Day this November.
Yeah. And by the way, all those comments were just wonderful. They all bring up different facets of this that are really rubbing at people, because they highlight the unfairness, they highlight the hypocrisy, again, on the school choice point, and also just the disparity in who gets this and the lack of government accountability or follow-up, right? There's no way of knowing who's really getting this money and how it, in the end, benefits their life, because money is fungible. A loan is a loan. The money gets paid off. You can then use it for other things not related to the career you studied for, et cetera, and so on. So all very valid points. But I think also notable is you take this anger and then you add it to the general fury that people have felt over the last couple of years over education in general, COVID, school closures, critical race theory. I think it can really become a very potent political issue in this midterm, and that we're going to see it in particular in certain districts, competitive districts. The national polls may not always pick up those trends, but it'll be fascinating to look, for instance, some of the votes in suburban districts where this has really resonated, and see how the midterms turn out in those areas.
Thank you, Kim and Alicia. Thank you all for listening. If you are equally bewildered and incensed at this student loan forgiveness plan, you can always email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And if you like the show, please hit that subscribe button. Wall Street Journal members can also join Paul Jugot, Kimberly Strassel, and Karl Rove for a live opinion event, Can Republicans Retake Congress, on Monday, October 17th at 7 p.m., that will be in Dallas or streamed online. And for more information, go to wsjplus.com/opinionlive for tickets and more information. And as always, we'll be back here tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.